This is the third day of this January 2017 Rohatsu 7-day Sesshin. And we'll return to the teachings of the 17th century Japanese Zen master Bankei. And we're reading from a book called Bankei Zen by Peter Haskell. These are translations of his talks. We left off yesterday with him hammering away at the point that none of us inherits our defilements from our parents. We don't get them from outside. We choose, in a sense, to act in ways that are contrary to our true nature, the unborn. And then he tells a story here. When I was young, there was a notorious thief in these parts called the Kappa, a fellow who would boldly rob people on the highway, seizing their money. He had remarkable talent as a thief. When he caught sight of someone coming from across the way, he could tell exactly how much money he had on him and was never off by even a hair. That's what a formidable fellow he was. But one day he got himself nabbed and served a long term in the prison at Osaka. The years passed, and then because he was such an expert as a thief, he was spared execution to become an informer for the police. Later he was excused from being an informer as well and became a free man. Afterward, he learned to carve Buddhist figures, becoming a maker of Buddha figures, and settling in Osaka, now an expert at carving Buddhas, completely reversing his former wicked state of mind. He devoted himself to liberation and ended his days absorbed in chanting the Nembutsu. So, even such a notorious brigand as the Kappa, once he'd reformed, ended his days in religious devotion. Where can you find anyone who steals because his karma is deep or his sins heavy? Stealing is the karma. Stealing is the sin. If it weren't for stealing, that sin and karma couldn't exist. This is a very, very important point he's making. Is don't attribute bad behavior to something inherent in the person's character. It's true that we form habits, and then habits can form into character, basic character structure, but none of this is intrinsic to our nature. Stealing is the karma. Stealing is the transgression. If it weren't for the action, the conduct, that karma couldn't exist. Whether you steal or whether you don't depends on the present state of your own mind, not on your past karma. And what I'm telling you now doesn't go only for stealing. Generally speaking, all delusions are just the same as stealing. Whether you're going to be deluded or not depends on the present state of your own mind. So, again, this is the freedom side of things. The other side is a tendency to take the habitual path, take the path of least resistance and just follow our bad instincts, our habits. But that's only part of it. The other is that actually at any moment in time, we do have this freedom of choice. Then he says, when you're deluded, you're an unenlightened being. When you're not deluded, you're a Buddha. There's no special shortcut to being a Buddha beyond this. Isn't it so? So I think our tendency more in the West is to see, because of our strong native belief in a self, in some inner self that has some immutable quality to it, we tend to think that a bad person is somehow bad by nature. Bankei is rejecting this. Our nature is mutable. That's our true nature. That's our Buddha nature. That's the unborn. Is there's no fixed substance to it. There's nothing fixed about our nature. It has no self nature to it that's unchanging. This is the whole basis of practice and training, is that we can change. And we find this freedom to choose to respond to circumstances, to people, the freedom to choose in a way that does not cause harm through practice, through daily practice. And above all, ultimately through realization. Reading this passage this morning reminded me of a key discussion by Yasutani Roshi in the Three Pillars of Zen. This is in his commentary on the Koan Mu. I'm just going to read a few sentences. What then is Buddha nature? Or we can substitute for Buddha nature the unborn, Bankei's unborn, or original mind. It's all the same. Briefly, the nature of everything is such that it can become Buddha. This is Buddha nature. Everything can reach self-completion, can come and to its full potential is such a dull word, but can realize itself. Every one of us can realize our nature. We all can integrate this nature into our daily lives and respond as the enlightened beings that we are. Again, Buddha nature, the nature of everything is such that it can become Buddha. Stated differently, he says, all phenomena are transformations of Buddha nature. Everything by its very nature is subject to the process of infinite transformation. This is its Buddha or Dharma nature. We all are in flux. We are change. Each one of us is change. There's no self here that's unchanging. And he says, what is the substance of this Buddha nature? In Buddhism, it is called shunyata, or the Japanese ku, is that which is living, dynamic, devoid of mass, unfixed, beyond individuality or personality, the matrix of all phenomena. So we're not stuck with a self. Whatever self-image we've dragged in at any moment is not us. It's an image. It's a notion, an idea, a concept. There's nobody here, nobody unchanging. This is the most optimistic, while at the same time realistic, understanding of human nature that we could possibly have. We're not stuck being anything. Here he talks about falling asleep in the Zendo. On the opening day of Rohatsu, that's now, that's this week, the master addressed the assembly. In my place, our normal everyday life is meditation. So it's not like everywhere else where they announce, from today on, meditation. And everyone specially hurls himself into frantic practice. Well, that's what we're doing. Basically, we're jacking up our efforts, which outside of Sesshin are mostly pretty on a pilot light, and we're turning up the heat in order that we can see more deeply into this mind. The master then went on to say, once while I was in Dosha's assembly, that's the master he came to enlightenment under, a monk was sleeping, seated in meditation. Another monk there suddenly struck him, but I scolded him for doing this. Why should you hit someone who's pleasantly sleeping? I said. When that monk is sleeping, do you think he's a different person? And then Bankei continues, I'm not encouraging people to sleep, but to hit them because they do is terribly wrong. Here in my place now, I don't allow that sort of thing. While I'm not encouraging people to sleep, I don't hit them or scold them for doing so. I don't scold or praise sleeping, and I don't scold or praise not sleeping. Whether people happen to be asleep or awake, just let them be as they are. When they're asleep, they're sleeping in the Buddha mind they were awake in. When they're awake in the Buddha mind they were sleeping in. When people are asleep, they're sleeping in the Buddha mind. When they're awake in the Buddha mind. They're always abiding in the Buddha mind, and there's not a moment when they're ever abiding in anything else. Well, this is what made Bankei a controversial figure among Zen teachers in Japan. There is paragraph I didn't read in the introduction, where it says, to Hakuin, Bankei's freewheeling teaching of the unborn was anathema, and he denounced it emphatically. And I think what that refers to is a thing like this, that you're always in the unborn, so what does it matter whether you're sleeping or not? This is pretty out there among Zen teachers. Zen Master Dogen, his enlightenment came about when his teacher struck a sleeping monk in the Zenda with his slipper, as count goes, and the words that that teacher used turned Dogen's mind. So we know, well, we know in many sources that that whereas what Bankei says may be true on paper, if you're sleeping, what are you? How are you going to change anything? Well, Bankei would say, well, there's no need to change anything. We're always in this unborn Buddha mind. Yeah, but who wants to waste time while meditating, sleeping? Someone asked, everybody says that you have the power to read people's minds. Is it true? Bankei said, in my school we don't have such extraordinary things. And even if we did, since the Buddha mind is unborn, we wouldn't use them. So when I'm speaking to you, I deal with your own selves, so you imagine I've got the power to read people's minds. But I don't have any mind-reading powers. I'm just the same as all of you. When you abide in the unborn, you're at the source of the supernatural powers of all the Buddhas, and without even having to seek supernatural power, all things are perfectly managed and smoothly dealt with. In the true teaching of the unborn, you can manage everything by dealing with your own self without bringing in all sorts of extraneous matters. When he, again, when he says when you abide in the unborn, this means when you can refrain from attaching to thoughts. It's not some mysterious secret place that we have to go to. It's just refraining from being involved with our thoughts. It's a state of no thought. This last sentence, you can manage everything by dealing with your own self without bringing in all sorts of extraneous matters. We're very, just to widen this, we're very limited in what we can do to change others. Almost everyone has someone or a number of people in their lives that they would like to see change. But that's also a waste of time to make other people our project. Our work in Zen is to turn the mind into our own, look into our own mind, turn the mind back and see the nature, our own nature. And then things will resolve themselves as they need to, if we're doing that. If we're taking care of business, as, of course, everyone here who's come here now is doing. If we can do that all the time, then that's about as much as we can do. There was a very popular play, may have been on Broadway, and about marriage and partnership, and the name of the play was "I Love You, You're Perfect, Now Change." We find in a long-term partnership like marriage that we're not going to have much luck changing the other person. So why waste time trying to look at your own responsibility and any problems in your partnership. Look at yourself. How are you contributing to it? What is my responsibility to it? That's a more enlightened approach to dealing with problems in relationships. It's the rarest rarest of approaches, but it's the one. There's a common problem. A certain man asked, "I've practiced as hard as I can, trying to advance without slipping back. But no matter what I do, the tendency to backslide is strong, and there are times when I regress. However much I try to advance, I only fall back again. How can I keep from regressing?" I think some of you will pretty much and be able to anticipate Bhante's response, more or less. The master said, "Abide in the unborn Buddha mind. When you do, you won't need to bother about advancing or regressing. In fact, when you abide in the unborn, trying to advance is to instantly regress from the place of the unborn. The man of the unborn has nothing to do with advancing or regressing, but always transcends them both." Here, too, what we can take from this is to not waste time thinking about the progress we're making or not making. This is one of the fundamental problems in Zen practice, and the most common, is instead of just is working on the practice that we're that is ours, we are thinking about our so-called practice. And thinking about a practice usually means thinking about whether we're doing it right, thinking about whether we might be able to find a way to do it better, thinking about whether we're making progress or backsliding, all these things. This is thinking about our practice. It's not the practice itself. The practice itself is what is it? Or that's the thing itself, the experience, not thoughts about practice. People can spend years thinking they're really doing Zen practice, and what they're doing is thinking about their practice. It's so easy to do because of a long habit that we, when we are seeing something, what we see as a problem, that we think about it instead of simply being the practice. One day the master addressed the assembly. "All delusions, without exception, are created as a result of self-centeredness. When you're free from self-centeredness, delusions won't be produced. For example, suppose your neighbors are having a quarrel. If you're not personally involved, you just hear what's going on and don't get angry. Not only do you not get angry, but you can plainly tell the rights and wrongs of the case. It's clear to you as you listen who's right and who's wrong. But let it be something that concerns you personally, and you find yourself getting involved with what the other party says or does, attaching to it and obscuring the marvelously illuminating function of the Buddha mind. Before, you could clearly tell wrong from right, but now, led by self-centeredness, you insist that your own idea of what's right is right, whether it is or not. Becoming angry, you thoughtlessly switch your Buddha mind for a fighting demon, and everyone takes to arguing bitterly with each other." Well, what we also see played out so spectacularly in the world today is the same sort of thing. but more in terms of the group or the we identify with. My people, whatever that means, ethnic group, race, tribe of some kind, religion. You see it most plainly in places like the Middle East, where if you're a Sunni, then no Shiite can be any good, and vice versa, and on and on and on it goes, has gone for centuries. My religion. In Zen, we are going to the root of this I and my. That's the source of all this tremendous oceans of blood and tears and misery. It's this self, what he calls self-centeredness. He continues, because the Buddha mind is marvelously illuminating, the traces of everything you've done are spontaneously reflected. It's when you attach to these reflected traces that you produce delusion. Thoughts don't actually exist in the place where the traces are reflected and then arise. We retain the things we saw and heard in the past, and when these things come up, they appear as traces and are reflected. Originally, thoughts have no real substance. So if they're reflected, just let them be reflected. If they arise, just let them arise. If they stop, just let them stop. As long as you're not attaching to these reflected traces, delusions won't be produced. So long as you're not attaching to them, you won't be deluded. And then, no matter how many traces are reflected, it would be just as if they weren't reflected at all. Even if 100 or 1,000 thoughts spring up, it will be just the same as if they never arose. It won't be any problem for you. No thoughts to, quote, clear away. No thoughts to, quote, cut off. Here, too, so fundamental, such a fundamental point Bankei is making, that thoughts in themselves needn't be a problem. They just come and go. It's when we build thoughts on top of thoughts, or we compound the problem by thinking about our thoughts, that we get ourselves all mired in delusion. One of the most important things we eventually learn through long practice is not to fight our thoughts, not to make a problem out of them. It's like being out in the snow, it would be the height of foolishness to think that we would need to stop the snow. The snow is not going to be stopped. It's just going to keep snowing. And the more you make a problem out of the snow coming down, the more you just unnecessarily cause misery for yourself. here's an exchange where a monk tries to get a rise out of Bankei by commenting on the canon that Bankei himself had carved. When Bankei was giving a teisho, this monk stood leaning against a pillar. That tells you everything you need to know about the monk. Stood leaning against a pillar and asked, "Is that figure an old Buddha or a new Buddha?" Now, to help people understand what's going on here, in Asia, much more than in our culture, age would mean something venerable, and new, believe it or not, new would be something less valuable. So, in his own indirect way, he's casting aspersions on this Buddha figure. Is that figure an old Buddha or a new Buddha? The master replied, "How does it look to you?" The monk said, "It looks to me like a new Buddha." The master said, "If it looks to you like a new Buddha, then it's a new Buddha, and that's that. So what's the problem?" Because you haven't understood that what is unborn is the Buddha mind, you come and ask this sort of useless thing, thinking that's Zen. Rather than ask this kind of worthless stuff and disturb everyone, just keep quiet. Take a seat and listen carefully to what I'm saying. Zen Master Dogen somewhere says very strongly that no matter how well made a Buddha figure is, it is worthy of veneration. And no matter how poorly made it is, it's worthy of veneration. The new Buddha figure, that 7-foot Buddha figure we have now in the basement here at Chapin Mill, has the most inspiring face, but there, the rest of it, there are things that could be better, like the dark shellac on it, but it's teaching in its own way. It's a wonderful new presence down there. A layman from Izumo presented himself for Doksan with the master and asked, "When one is enlightened like the master, do the three worlds really appear as if they were glimpsed in the palm of the hand?" The master said, "Is that question something you've been thinking over, or is it something that suddenly occurred to you just now to ask?" He knew the answer to that, but anyway, the layman said, "Well, I didn't really form this question on the spur of the moment, but as I've been mulling it over and just happened to think of it now, I asked you about it." The master told him, "In that case, you needn't bother asking about my affairs. Your wanting to see the three worlds can wait. First, thoroughly examine your own self, what's really essential right here and now. Until you've examined your own self, however much I tell you about how things look to me, you won't be recognizing it, seeing it, or settling it for yourself. So you won't be convinced. And even if you did believe it, you still wouldn't be proving my words. That is, confirming through your own experience my words. Since you won't have seen the three worlds for yourself, it won't be of any use to you. When you thoroughly examine your own self, you'll know for yourself both the visible and invisible. There won't be any need for me to tell you or for you to ask me. Without first of all thoroughly examining your own nature, what's really essential right here and now, You come asking me extraneous questions about whether or not the three worlds can be seen, all of which can easily wait. It's just getting sidetracked, going off on a tangent. It's all irrelevant to you, like counting up my money for me without having even half a cent of your own. The translator here, in parentheses, says the three worlds is the past, present, and future. And that's one way to understand the three worlds. More commonly, when we run across this allusion to the three worlds in Buddhist texts, it refers to the world of desire, the world of form, and the world of formlessness, which I think is more likely what this questioner meant, given that Bankei refers to both the visible and the invisible. A monk asks, "When I'm sleeping soundly, I have dreams. How is it that we have dreams? I'd like your opinion on this." The master said, "When a person is sound asleep, he doesn't have dreams. When you have dreams, you're not sleeping soundly." The monk was speechless. Regarding dreams, during Sesshin and right after Sesshin, I've said this a few times, but for new people, expect your dreams to be unusual during Sesshin and afterward. More than unusual, dreams at these times can be disturbing. You can have the most grotesque, most violent and depraved dreams during Sesshin and afterward. And I've come to learn this is quite a common experience. Yeah, but nothing to be concerned about. This work in Sesshin is such deep excavation we're doing things are coming to the surface don't normally come to our awareness. Don't make the mistake of thinking it reflects on your character because you're having depraved, violent, perverse, weird dreams. I see it as just a flushing process. The problem would come if we think that it says something about us, something about our inner self. It's just cleansing. For all we know, it could be material has come from lifetimes and lifetimes ago. Or just images, things we've seen or read about. We form images from reading, not just from seeing things. But at the same time, this argues for not exposing ourselves to any more such disturbing images or reading than we need to. There's this this feature of Buddhist psychology called the alaya vijnana, the storehouse consciousness. The idea is that everything we perceive, everything, the smallest thing, a spot of sunlight, a fly, and every little thing, a corner of furniture, everything is filed away in this storehouse consciousness. And as seeds of future experiences, we call this karma. And the more of that we're absorbing, more unnecessary material, imagery and other things, the more likely we'll have to contend with those things when they sprout later. And later could mean an hour later, or can mean 10 lifetimes later. This is one of the great assets of the monastic life, is one is not exposed to a lot of extraneous, much less disturbing material. The Buddha mind, unborn and marvelously illuminating, is like a bright mirror. A mirror reflects whatever is in front of it. It's not deliberately trying to reflect things, but whatever comes before the mirror, its color and form, are sure to appear. Likewise, when the object being reflected is removed, the mirror isn't deliberately trying not to reflect it, but when it's taken away, it doesn't appear in the mirror. The unborn Buddha mind is just like this. It's natural that you see and hear things, whatever they are, when you deliberately try to see and hear them, but when you see and hear things that you hadn't originally anticipated seeing or hearing, it's through the dynamic function of the Buddha mind that every one of you has. So again, his examples that he uses many times in this book about hearing a sound he hadn't expected, the cawing of a crow, a cough on the other side of the zendo, any kind of sound, hearing is the functioning of this true nature of ours. Here's something that I like to read because it shows not just his kind of revolutionary way of seeing things, but also his courage in saying things as they are. And the context here is women's equality. In 17th century Japan, like China, no doubt, and Korea, women had a very much subordinate position to men, and it played out in all kinds of ways. And there were even those who said, I guess, somewhere that women couldn't come to enlightenment, which is, of course, utter rubbish. But here, let's hear it from Bankei. I can tell you something about this matter of women's Buddha mind. I understand that women feel very distressed hearing it said that they can't become Buddhas, meaning I can't become enlightened. But it simply isn't so! Exclamation mark. How is there any difference between men and women? Men are the Buddha body and women are the Buddha body too. You shouldn't entertain any doubts of this sort. When you thoroughly grasp the unborn, then in the unborn there's no difference whether you're a man or a woman. Everyone is the Buddha body. Well, our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows. All beings without number, I vow to liberate. Endless blind passions, I vow to uproot. Dharma gains beyond measure, I vow to penetrate. The great way of Buddha, I vow to attain. All beings without number, I vow to liberate. Endless blind passions, I vow to uproot. Dharma gains beyond measure, I vow to penetrate. The great way of Buddha, I vow to attain. All beings without number, I vow to liberate. Endless blind passions, I vow to uproot. Dharma gains beyond measure, I vow to penetrate. The great way of Buddha, I vow to attain.